internal Democratic problems while failing to cover divisions in the Senate GOP. To make his point, he pulled out a memorandum on a recent private meeting at which the reporter and several of his colleagues had gotten a briefing on GOP factionalism from Senator Thurston Morton, the Republican from Kentucky. Roland Evans and Robert Novak recalled, "The intelligence system was a marvel of efficiency. It was also rather frightening." Even in the White House, Johnson believed in first-hand political intelligence. According to his aide, Harry McPherson, "I guess he called a lot of people, but I could usually count on it in the late afternoon as he woke up from his nap, that I would get a call which would usually say, 'What do you know?'" McPherson would then pass along the latest news that he picked up from reporters and political figures. From Lives of Master Swordsmen by Makoto Sugawara. In all the martial arts, in all the performing arts, and still more in all the forms of human behavior, a man's postures or moves are based on the movements of his invisible mind. In the Kage style of swordsmanship, a swordsman reads his opponent's mind through his postures or moves. What mind can penetrate his opponent's mind? It is a mind that has been trained and cultivated to the point of detachment, with perfect freedom. It is as clear as a mirror that can reflect the motions within his opponent's mind. When one stands face to face with his opponents, his mind must not be revealed in the form of moves. Instead, his mind should reflect his opponent's mind like water reflecting the moon. Again, from Lives of Master Swordsmen by Makoto Sugawara. When Munenori was granted an audience with the shogun, he sat down, put his hands on the tatami floor, as retainers always did to show their respect to their master. Suddenly, Iemitsu thrust a spear at the unsuspecting Munenori, and was surprised to find himself lying flat on his back. Munenori had sensed the shogun's intention before a move had been made and swept Iemitsu's legs out from under him at the instant of the thrust. By Miyamoto Musashi. In my opinion, there are two kinds of eyes. One kind simply looks at things, and the other sees through things to perceive their inner nature. The former should not be tense, so as to observe as much as possible. The latter should be strong, so as to discern the workings of the opponent's mind clearly. Sometimes, a man can read another's mind with his eyes. In fencing, it is all right to allow your own eyes to express your will, but never let them reveal your mind. This matter should be considered carefully and studied diligently. From Human, All Too Human by Friedrich Nietzsche. Anger as Spy. Anger empties out the soul and brings even its dregs to light. That is why, if we know no other way of discovering the truth of the matter, we must know how to put our acquaintances, our adherents and opponents, into a rage, so as to learn all that is really being thought and undertaken against us. From the Book of Samuel. Then David fled from Naoth in Ramah, and came and said before Jonathan, "What have I done? What is my guilt? And what is my sin before your father that he seeks my life?" And he said to him, "Far from it. You shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me. And why should my father hide this from me? It is not so." But David replied, "Your father knows well that I have found favor in your eyes. And he thinks, 'Let not Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved.' But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death." Then said Jonathan to David, "Whatever you say, I will do for you." David said to Jonathan, "Behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit at table with the king. But let me go, that I may hide myself in the field till the third day at evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family. If he says, good, it will be well with your servant. But if he is angry, then know that evil is determined by him. And Jonathan said to David, come, let us go out into the field. So they both went out into the field. So David hid himself in the field. And when the new moon came, the king sat down to eat food. The king sat upon his seat, as at other times, upon the seat by the wall. Jonathan sat opposite, and Abner sat by Saul's side, but David's place was empty. Yet Saul did not say anything that day, for he thought, something has befallen him. He is not clean. Surely he is not clean. But on the second day, the morrow after the new moon, David's place was empty. And Saul said to Jonathan his son, why has not the son of Jesse come to the meal, either yesterday or today? Jonathan answered Saul, David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. He said, let me go, for our family holds a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to be there. So now, if I have found favor in your eyes, let me get away and see my brothers. For this reason he has not come to the king's table. Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan, and he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame, and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives upon the earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established. Therefore send and fetch him to me, for he shall surely die. Then Jonathan answered Saul his father, why should he be put to death? What has he done? But Saul cast his spear at him to smite him. So Jonathan knew that his father was determined to put David to death. And Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David, because his father had disgraced him. By Friedrich Nietzsche. Motive of attack. One attacks someone not only so as to harm him or to overpower him, but perhaps only so as to learn how strong he is. From Hagakure, The Book of the Samurai, by Yamamoto Tsunetomo. Last year at a great conference there was a certain man who explained his dissenting opinion and said he was resolved to kill the conference leader if it was not accepted. His motion was passed. After the procedures were over, the man said, their assent came quickly. I think they are too weak and unreliable to be counselors to the master. From Warriors, Warfare and the Native American Indian, by Norman Bancroft Hunt. Colonel Joe Cremeny commented on their adeptness at seeming to disappear when he wrote, an Apache can conceal his swart body amidst the green grass, behind brown shrubs or gray rocks, with so much address and judgment that any but the experienced would pass him by without detection at the distance of 3 or 4 yards, and noted that they will watch for days, scanning your every movement, observing your every act, taking exact note of your party and all its belongings. Let no one suppose that these assaults are made upon the spur of the moment by bands accidentally encountered. Far from it. They are almost invariably the results of long watching, patient waiting, careful and rigorous observation, and anxious counsel. And lastly, from The Secret Agent by Joseph Conrad. In principle, I should lay it down that the existence of secret agents should not be tolerated, as tending to augment the positive dangers of the evil against which they are used. That the spy will fabricate his information is a commonplace. But in the sphere of political and revolutionary action, relying partly on violence, the professional spy has every facility to fabricate the very facts themselves and will spread the double evil of emulation in one direction, and of panic, hasty legislation, unreflecting hate, on the other. Chapter 14. Overwhelm resistance with speed and suddenness. The Blitzkrieg strategy. In a world in which many people are indecisive and overly cautious, the use of speed will bring you untold power. Striking first, before your opponents have time to think or prepare, will make them emotional, unbalanced, and prone to error. When you follow with another swift and sudden maneuver, you will induce further panic and confusion. This strategy works best with a setup, a lull. Your unexpected action catches your enemy off guard. When you strike, hit with unrelenting force. Acting with speed and decisiveness will garner you respect, awe, and irresistible momentum. Slow, slow, quick, quick. In 1218, Muhammad II, the Shah of Khwarezm, received a visit from three ambassadors on behalf of Genghis Khan, the leader of the Mongol Empire to the east. The visitors bore magnificent gifts, and more important, the offer of a treaty between the two powers that would allow the reopening of the lucrative Silk Road connecting China and Europe. The Shah's empire was immense, incorporating present-day Iran and much of Afghanistan. His capital, Samarkand, was fabulously wealthy, a symbol of his power, and increased trade along the route would only add to these riches. Since the Mongols made it clear they considered him the superior partner in the deal, the Shah decided to sign the treaty. A few months later, a Mongol caravan arrived in the city of Otrar, in the northeastern corner of the Shah's empire, with a mission to buy luxury items for the Mongol court. The governor of Otrar suspected the men in the caravan of being spies. He had them killed, and he seized the goods they had brought to barter. Hearing of this outrage, Genghis Khan dispatched an ambassador, escorted by two soldiers, to the Shah, calling for an apology. The demand, which presumed to put the two empires on equal footing, incensed the Shah. He had the ambassador's head cut off and sent back to Genghis Khan. This, of course, meant war. The Shah was not afraid. His army, anchored by its well-trained Turkish cavalry, numbered over 400,000, at least twice the enemy's size. By defeating the Mongols in battle, the Shah could finally take over their land. He assumed the Mongols would attack Transoxiana, the easternmost part of the Shah's empire. Bordered to the east by the 500-mile-long Sirdarya River, to the north by the Kizilkum Desert, and the west by the Amudarya River, Transoxiana's interior was also home to two of the most important cities of the empire, Samarkand and Bukhara. The Shah decided to establish a cordon of soldiers along the Sirdarya, which the Mongols would have to cross to enter his empire. They could not cross from the north, the desert was impassable, and to go to the south would be too great a detour. Keeping the bulk of his army in the interior of Transoxiana, he would be able to place reinforcements where needed. He had an impregnable defensive position and superiority in numbers. Let the Mongols come. He would crush them. In the summer of 1219, scouts reported that the Mongols were approaching the southern end of the Sirdarya through the Fergana Valley. The Shah sent a large force under the leadership of his son, Jalal ad-Din, to destroy the enemy. After a fierce battle, the Mongols retreated. Jalal ad-Din reported back to his father that the Mongol army was not nearly as fearsome as their reputation. The men looked haggard, their horses emaciated, and they seemed none too eager to sustain a fight. The Shah, believing the Mongols no match for his army, put more troops at the southern end of the cordon and waited. A few months later, a Mongol battalion appeared without warning in the north, attacking the city of Otrar and capturing its governor, the same man responsible for the outrage against the Mongol traders. The Mongols killed him by pouring molten silver into his eyes and ears. Stunned by how quickly they had managed to reach Otrar, and from an unexpected direction, the Shah decided to shift more troops to the north. These barbarians might move swiftly, he reasoned, but they could not overcome an entrenched army with such great numbers. Next, however, two Mongol armies swept south from Otrar, running parallel to the Sir Darya. One, under General Joshi, began to attack key towns along the river, while the other, under General Jebe, disappeared to the south. Like locusts, Joshi's army swarmed through the hills and lowlands near the river. The Shah moved a good portion of his army to the river, keeping some reserves in Samarkand. Joshi's force was relatively small, 20,000 at most. These mobile units hit one position after another without warning, burning forts and wreaking havoc. Reports from the front lines began to give the Shah a picture of these strange warriors from the east. Their army was all cavalry. Each Mongol not only rode a horse, but was trailed by several more riderless horses, all mares, and when his own horse tired, he would mount a fresh one. These horses were light and fast. The Mongols were unencumbered by supply wagons. They carried their food with them, drank the mare's milk and blood, and killed and ate the horses that had become weak. They could travel twice as fast as their enemy. Their marksmanship was extraordinary. Facing forward or in retreat, they could fire arrows with remarkable dexterity, making their attacks far deadlier than anything the Shah's army had ever seen. Their divisions communicated over great distances with flags and torches. Their maneuvers were precisely coordinated and nearly impossible to anticipate. Dealing with this constant harassment exhausted the Shah's forces. Now, suddenly, the army under General Jebe, that had disappeared to the south, reappeared heading northwest into Transoxiana at remarkable speed. The Shah hurriedly sent south his last reserves, an army of 50,000, to do battle with Jebe. He still was not worried. His men had proved their superiority in direct combat at the battle in the Fergana Valley. This time, however, it was different. The Mongols unleashed strange weapons. Their arrows were dipped in burning tar, which created smoke screens behind which their lightning-quick horsemen advanced, opening breaches in the lines of the Shah's army through which more heavily armed cavalry would advance. Chariots darted back and forth behind the Mongol lines, bringing up constant supplies. The Mongols filled the sky with arrows, creating relentless pressure. They wore shirts of heavy silk. An arrow that managed to pierce the shirt would rarely reach the flesh, and could be extracted easily by pulling at the shirt, all of this done while moving at great speed. Jebe's army annihilated the Shah's forces. The Shah had one option left: retreat to the west, retrench, and slowly rebuild his army. As he began preparations, however, something beyond belief occurred. An army under Genghis Khan himself suddenly stood outside the gates of the city of Bukhara, to the west of Samarkand. Where had they come from? They could not have crossed the Kizilkum Desert to the north. Their appearance seemed all but impossible, as if the devil himself had conjured them up. Bukhara soon fell, and within days Samarkand followed. Soldiers deserted, generals panicked. The Shah, fearing for his life, fled with a handful of soldiers. The Mongols pursued him relentlessly. Months later, on a small island in the Caspian Sea, abandoned by one and all, wearing rags and begging for food, the former ruler of the wealthiest empire in the East finally died of hunger. Interpretation. When Genghis Khan became the leader of the Mongol nation, he inherited perhaps the fastest army on the planet, but their swiftness had translated into limited military success. The Mongols might have perfected the art of fighting on horseback, but they were too undisciplined to exploit any advantage they gained this way or to coordinate for a large-scale attack. The genius of Genghis Khan was to transform the chaotic Mongol speed into something organized, disciplined, and strategic. He achieved this by adapting the ancient Chinese strategy of slow, slow, quick, quick. The first step, a slow, was to meticulously prepare before any campaign, which the Mongols always did to the highest degree. In planning for the attack on the Shah, the Mongols learned of a guide who knew of a chain of oases across the Kizilkum Desert. This man was captured and later led Genghis Khan's army across the forbidding territory. The second slow was a setup, which involved getting the enemy to lower its guard, lulling it into complacency. The Mongols, for example, deliberately lost the first battle in the Fergana Valley to feed the Shah's arrogance. Then came the first quick, fixing the enemy's attention forward with a swift frontal attack, Jebe's raids along the river. The final quick was a doubly swift blow from an unexpected direction. Genghis's sudden appearance before the gates of Bukhara is considered by many the greatest military surprise in history. A master of psychological warfare, Genghis Khan understood that men are most terrified by the unknown and unpredictable. The suddenness of his attacks made the speed of them doubly effective, leading to confusion and panic. We live in a world in which speed is prized above almost all else, and acting faster than the other side has itself become the primary goal. But most often people are merely in a hurry, acting and reacting frantically to events, all of which makes them prone to error and wasting time in the long run. In order to separate yourself from the pack, to harness a speed that has devastating force, you must be organized and strategic. First, you prepare yourself before any action, scanning your enemy for weaknesses. Then you find a way to get your opponents to underestimate you, to lower their guard. When you strike unexpectedly, they will freeze up. When you hit again, it is from the side and out of nowhere. It is the unanticipated blow that makes the biggest impact. By Xenophon, the less a thing is foreseen, the more fright does it cause. This is nowhere seen better than in war, where every surprise strikes terror even to those who are much the stronger. Keys to Warfare. In May 1940, the German army invaded France and the Low Countries using a new form of warfare, the Blitzkrieg. Advancing with incredible speed, the Germans coordinated tanks and airplanes in an attack that culminated in one of the quickest and most devastating victories in military history. The success of the Blitzkrieg was largely due to the Allies' static, rigid defense, similar to the Shah's defense against the Mongols. When the Germans breached this defense, the Allies could not adjust or react in time. The Germans advanced faster than their enemy could process what was happening. By the time the Allies decided upon a counter-strategy, it was too late. Conditions had changed. They were always a step behind. Now, more than ever, we find ourselves dealing with people who are defensive and cautious, who begin any action from a static position. The reason is simple. The pace of modern life is increasingly growing faster, full of distractions, annoyances, and interruptions. The natural response for many is to retreat inward, to erect psychological walls against the harsh realities of modern life. People hate the feeling of being rushed and are terrified of making a mistake. They unconsciously try to slow things down by taking longer to make decisions, being noncommittal, defensive, and cautious. Blitzkrieg warfare, adapted for daily combat, is the perfect strategy for these times. While those around you remain defensive and immobile, you surprise them with sudden and decisive action, forcing them to act before they are ready. They cannot respond as they usually do by being elusive or cautious. They will most likely become emotional and react imprudently. You have breached their defenses, and if you keep up the pressure and hit them again with something unexpected, you will send them into a kind of downward psychological spiral, pushing them into mistakes, which further deepens their confusion, and so the cycle goes on. Many of those who practiced a form of blitzkrieg warfare on the battlefield used it to great effect in daily life. Julius Caesar, master of speed and surprise, was a great example of this. From out of the blue, he might form an alliance with the senator's bitterest enemy, forcing the senator either to change his opposition to Caesar or to risk a dangerous confrontation. Equally, He might unexpectedly pardon a man who had fought against him. Caught off guard, the man would become a loyal ally. Caesar's reputation for doing the unpredictable made people all the more cautious in his presence, further enhancing his ability to catch those around him unawares. This strategy works wonders on those who are particularly hesitant and afraid of making any kind of mistake. In similar fashion, if you are facing an enemy that has divided leadership or internal cracks, a sudden and swift attack will make the cracks larger and cause internal collapse. Half of the success of Napoleon Bonaparte's form of blitzkrieg warfare was that he used it against armies of allies in which several bickering generals were in charge of strategy. Once his army broke through these armies' defenses, dissension would break out and they would fall apart from within. The blitzkrieg strategy can be effective in diplomacy, too, as Henry Kissinger demonstrated. The former U.S. Secretary of State would often take his time when beginning diplomatic negotiations, lulling the other side with bland banter. Then, with the deadline for the end of the talks approaching, he would suddenly hit them with a list of demands. Without enough time to process what was happening, they became prone to giving in or to becoming emotional and making mistakes. This was Kissinger's version of slow, slow, quick, quick. For their initial thrust into France during World War II, the Germans chose to attack through the Ardennes Forest in southern Belgium. The forest, considered impenetrable by tank, was lightly guarded. Pushing through this weak point, the Germans were able to build up speed and momentum. In launching a blitzkrieg, you must begin by finding your enemy's weak point. Initiating the action where there will be less resistance will allow you to develop crucial momentum. The success of this strategy depends on three things: a group that is mobile, often the smaller the better, superior coordination between the parts, and the ability to send orders quickly up and down the chain of command. Do not depend on technology to accomplish this. During the Vietnam War, the U.S. military might in fact have been hindered by its superior communications. Too much information to be processed made for slower response times. The North Vietnamese, who depended on a well-coordinated network of spies and informers, not gadgetry, made decisions more quickly, and as a result were more nimble on the ground. Shortly after being elected president in 1932, Franklin D. Roosevelt seemed to disappear from the public stage. The Depression was at its height, and for many Americans this was not very reassuring. Then, with his inauguration, Roosevelt changed tempo, giving a rousing speech that showed he had in fact been meditating deeply on the issues facing the country. In the weeks that followed, he came at Congress fast and furiously with a series of bold legislative proposals. The intensity of this new direction was felt all the more because of the slow setup. More than mere drama, the momentum built by this strategy helped Roosevelt to convince the public that he meant business and was leading the country in the right direction. The momentum translated into support for his policies, which in turn helped spur confidence and turn the economy around. Speed, then, is not only a powerful tool to use against an enemy, but it can also have a bracing, positive influence on those on your side. Frederick the Great noted that an army that moves quickly has higher morale. Velocity creates a sense of vitality. Moving with speed means there is less time for you and your army to make mistakes. It also creates a bandwagon effect. More and more people admiring your boldness will decide to join forces with you. Like Roosevelt, make such decisive action as dramatic as possible. A moment of quiet and suspense on the stage before you make your startling entrance. Reversal. Slowness can have great value, particularly as a setup. To appear slow and deliberate, even a little foolish, will lull your enemies, infecting them with a sleepy attitude. Once their guard is down, an unexpected blow from the side will knock them out. Your use of slowness and speed, then, should be deliberate and controlled, never a natural tempo that you fall into. In general, when facing a fast enemy, The only true defense is to be as fast or faster. Only speed can neutralize speed. Setting up a rigid defense, as the Shah did against the Mongols, only plays into the hands of the swift and mobile. Here are further reflections on the Blitzkrieg strategy. By Sun Tzu. War is such that the supreme consideration is speed. This is to take advantage of what is beyond the reach of the enemy, to go by way of routes where he least expects you, and to attack where he has made no preparations. From the I Ching. Chen, the arousing. Shock, thunder. The hexagram Chen represents the eldest son, who sees his rule with energy and power. The Yang line develops below two Yin lines and presses upward forcibly. This movement is so violent that it arouses terror. It is symbolized by thunder, which bursts forth from the earth and by its shock causes fear and trembling. The judgment shock brings success. Shock comes, oh, oh, laughing words, ha, ha. The shock terrifies for 100 miles. From Sting Like a Bee by Jose Torres and Bert Randolph Sugar. But the genius in Ali takes his limitations and makes them virtues. Let us go step by step. I can't think of a past heavyweight champion whose punching power wasn't superior to Ali's. Yet in his first 20 fights, Ali, then Cassius Clay, won every one of them, scoring 17 knockouts. So what is Ali's mystery? Why does a man who every expert agrees has no punching power knock most of his opponents out, including a one-punch KO over Sonny Liston on Ali's first defense of his title? The answer is in speed and timing. Clay then, and Ali now, has the ability to let punches go with extreme quickness, but most important, at the right moment, just before the man in front of him is able to put his boxer's sense of anticipation to work. When that happens, the man getting hit doesn't see the punch. As a result, this man's brain can't prepare him to receive the impact of the blow. The eyes couldn't send the message back to the part of the body which would take the shock. So we arrive at one knockout of a conclusion. The punch that puts you to sleep is not so much the hard punch as the punch that you don't see coming. And lastly, by Julius Caesar. Veni, vidi, vici. I came, I saw, I conquered. Chapter 15. Control the Dynamic. Forcing Strategies. People are constantly struggling to control you, getting you to act in their interests, keeping the dynamic on their terms. The only way to get the upper hand is to make your play for control more intelligent and insidious. Instead of trying to dominate the other side's every move, work to define the nature of the relationship itself. Shift the conflict to terrain of your choice, altering the pace and stakes to suit you. Maneuver to control your opponent's minds, pushing their emotional buttons and compelling them to make mistakes. If necessary, let them feel they are in control in order to get them to lower their guard. If you control the overall direction and framing of the battle, anything they do will play into your hands. The Art of Ultimate Control. Control is an issue in all relationships. It is human nature to abhor feelings of helplessness and to strive for power. Whenever two people or groups interact, there is a constant maneuvering between them to define the relationship, to determine who has control over this and that. This battle of wills is inevitable. Your task as a strategist is twofold. First, Recognize the struggle for control in all aspects of life and never be taken in by those who claim they are not interested in control. Such types are often the most manipulative of all. Second, you must master the art of moving the other side like pieces on a chessboard, with purpose and direction. This art was cultivated by the most creative generals and military strategists throughout the ages. War is above all else a struggle over who can control the actions of the other side to a greater extent. Military geniuses such as Hannibal, Napoleon, and Erwin Rommel discovered that the best way to attain control is to determine the overall pace, direction, and shape of the war itself. This means getting enemies to fight according to your tempo, luring them onto terrain that is unfamiliar to them and suited to you, playing to your strengths. And most important of all, it means gaining influence over the frame of mind of your opponents, adapting your maneuvers to their psychological weaknesses. The superior strategist understands that it is impossible to control exactly how an enemy will respond to this move or that. To attempt to do so will only lead to frustration and exhaustion. There is too much in war and in life that is unpredictable. But if the strategist can control the mood and mindset of his enemies, it does not matter exactly how they respond to his maneuvers. If he can make them frightened, panicky, overly aggressive, and angry, he controls the wider scope of their actions and can trap them mentally before cornering them physically. Control can be aggressive or passive. It can be an immediate push on the enemy, making him back up and lose the initiative. It can be playing possum, getting the enemy to lower his guard, or baiting him into a rash attack. The artist of control weaves both of these into a devastating pattern: hitting, backing off, baiting, overwhelming. This art is infinitely applicable to the battles of everyday life. Many people tend to play unconscious games of domination, or get caught up in trying to control someone else's every move. In trying to manage and determine too much, they exhaust themselves, make mistakes, push people away, and in the end, lose control of the situation. If you understand and master the art, you will instantly become more creative in your approach to influencing and controlling the other side. By determining people's moods, the pace at which they must move, the stakes involved, you will find that almost anything people do in response to your maneuvers will fit into the overall dynamic you have shaped. They may know they are being controlled, but be helpless to fight it. Or they may move in the direction you desire without realizing it. That is ultimate control. The following are the four basic principles of the art. Keep them on their heels. Before the enemy makes a move, before the element of chance or the unexpected actions of your opponents can ruin your plans, you make an aggressive move to seize the initiative. You then keep up a relentless pressure, exploiting this momentary advantage to the fullest. You do not wait for opportunities to open up. You make them yourself. If you are the weaker side, this will often more than level the playing field. Keeping your enemies on the defensive and in react mode will have a demoralizing effect on them. Shift the battlefield. An enemy naturally wants to fight you on familiar terrain. Terrain, in this sense, means all of the details of the battle: the time and place, exactly what is being fought over, who was involved in the struggle, and so on. By subtly shifting your enemies into places and situations that are not familiar to them, you control the dynamic. Without realizing what is happening, your opponents find themselves fighting on your terms. Compel mistakes. Your enemies depend on executing a strategy that plays to their advantages, that has worked in the past. Your task is twofold: to fight the battle in such a way that they cannot bring their strength or strategy into play, and to create such a level of frustration that they make mistakes in the process. You do not give them enough time to do anything. You play to their emotional weaknesses, making them as irritable as possible. You bait them into deadly traps, It is less your action than their missteps that give you control. Assume passive control. The ultimate form of domination is to make those on the other side think they are the ones in control. Believing they are in command, they are less likely to resist you or become defensive. You create this impression by moving with the energy of the other side, giving ground but slowly and subtly diverting them in the direction you desire. It is often the best way to control the overly aggressive and the passive aggressive. By Sun Tzu. One who excels at warfare compels men and is not compelled by others. Historical examples. 1. By the end of 1940, British forces in the Middle East had been able to secure their position in Egypt and take back a good part of Libya that the Italians, an ally of Germany, had seized early in World War II. Having captured the important port town of Benghazi, the British were poised to advance farther west, all the way to Tripoli, allowing them to push the Italians out of the country for good. Then, unexpectedly, a halt was called in their advance. General Archibald Wavell, commander-in-chief of British forces in the Middle East, was waging battle on too many fronts. Since the Italians had proved themselves to be rather inept in desert warfare, the British felt they could afford to create a defensive line in Libya, build up their forces in Egypt, and launch a major offensive against the Italians by April of the following year. News that a German armored brigade under the leadership of General Erwin Rommel had arrived in Tripoli in February 1941 did not alter the British plans. Rommel had been a superb commander during the Blitzkrieg in France the previous year, but here he was under Italian command, dependent on the incompetent Italians for supplies, and his force was too small to make the British nervous. In addition, intelligence reports revealed that Hitler had sent him there with orders to do no more than block the British from advancing to Tripoli. Then, without warning, at the end of March 1941, Rommel's tanks swept eastward. Rommel had broken up his small force into columns, and he hurled them in so many directions against the British defensive line that it was hard to fathom his intentions. These mechanized columns moved with incredible speed, advancing at night with lights dimmed. Time and again they caught their enemy by surprise, suddenly appearing to their flank or rear. As their line was breached in multiple places, the British were compelled to retreat farther and farther east. To Wavell, who was following these events from Cairo, this was downright shocking and humiliating. Rommel was causing chaos with a disproportionately small number of tanks and severe supply limitations. Within a few weeks, the Germans had advanced to the border of Egypt. What was most devastating about this offensive was the novel way in which Rommel fought. He used the desert as if it were an ocean. Despite supply problems and the difficult terrain, he kept his tanks in perpetual motion. The British could not let up their guard for a moment, and this mentally exhausted them. But his movements, though seemingly random, were always for a purpose. If he wanted to take a particular city, he would head in the opposite direction, then circle and attack from an unexpected side. He brought along an armada of trucks to kick up enough dust so that the British could not see where he was headed, and to give the impression of a much larger force than was actually on the attack. Rommel would ride with the front line, risking death so that he could make rapid judgments on the move, sending his columns here and there before the British had time to figure out the game. And he used his tanks in the opposite way of the British, to deadly effect. Instead of pushing them forward to punch holes in the enemy lines, he would send out his weakest tanks, then have them retreat at first contact. The British tanks would invariably swallow the bait and go in pursuit, kicking up so much of their own dust in the process that they would not see they were running straight into a line of German anti-tank guns. Once a sufficient number of British tanks had been taken out, Rommel would advance again, wreaking havoc behind the British lines. Kept constantly on their heels, forced to come to rapid decisions in response to Rommel's moves, the British made endless mistakes. Not knowing where he might show up next or from what direction, they spread their forces over dangerously vast areas. Before long, at the mere mention that a Russian column was approaching, Rommel at its head, the British would abandon their positions, even though they greatly outnumbered him. In the end, the only thing that stopped him was Hitler's obsession with Russia, which bled Rommel of the supplies and reinforcements he needed to conquer Egypt. Interpretation. This is how Rommel analyzed the situation first confronting him. The enemy had a strong position to the east, which would only get stronger as more supplies and men came from Egypt. Rommel had a much smaller force, and the longer he waited, the more useless it would become. And so he decided to disobey Hitler's orders, risking his career on a truth he had learned in the Blitzkrieg in France. Making the first hit against the enemy completely alters the dynamic. If the enemy is the stronger side, it is upsetting and discouraging to be suddenly put on the defensive. Being larger and unprepared makes it harder to organize an orderly retreat. To get his strategy to work, Rommel had to create maximum disorder in the enemy. In the ensuing confusion, the Germans would seem more formidable than they were. Speed, mobility, and surprise, as agents of such chaos, became ends in themselves. Once the enemy was on its heels, a deceptive maneuver, heading one way, then attacking from another, had double the effect. An enemy that is in retreat, and without time to think, will make endless mistakes if you keep up the pressure. Ultimately, the key to Rommel's success was to seize the initiative with one bold maneuver, then exploit this momentary advantage to the fullest. Everything in this world conspires to put you on the defensive. At work, your superiors may want the glory for themselves and will discourage you from taking the initiative. People are constantly pushing and attacking you, keeping you in react mode. You are continually reminded of your limitations and what you cannot hope to accomplish. You are made to feel guilty for this and that. Such defensiveness on your part can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Before anything, you need to liberate yourself from this feeling. By acting boldly before others are ready, by moving to seize the initiative, you create your own circumstances rather than simply waiting for what life brings you. Your initial push alters the situation, on your terms. People are made to react to you, making you seem larger and more powerful than may be the case. The respect and fear you inspire will translate into offensive power, a reputation that precedes you. Like Rommel, you must also have a touch of madness, ready to disorient and confuse for its own sake, to keep advancing no matter the circumstance. It is up to you. Be constantly defensive, or make others feel it instead. 2. In 1932, Paramount Pictures, following a craze for gangster films, began production on Night After Night. The film was to star George Raft, who had recently made a name for himself in Scarface. Raft was cast to type as a typical gangster. But Night After Night, in a twist, was to have a comic edge to it. The producer, William LeBaron, was afraid that there was no one in the cast who had a light enough touch to pull this off. Raft, hearing of his concern, suggested he hire Mae West. West was a celebrity in vaudeville and on Broadway, starring in plays she had written. She had made a reputation as a saucy, aggressive blonde with a devastating wit. Hollywood producers had thought of her before, but she was too bawdy for film. And by 1932, she was 39 years old, on the plump side, and considered too old to be making a film debut. Nevertheless, LeBaron was willing to take a risk to liven up the picture. She would create a splash, provide an angle for promotion, then be sent back to Broadway where she belonged. Paramount offered her a 2-month contract at $5,000 a week, a generous deal for the times. West happily accepted. At first, West was a little difficult. She had been told to lose some weight, but she hated dieting and quickly gave up. Instead, she had her hair dyed a rather indecent platinum blonde. She hated the script, the dialogue was flat, and her character unimportant. The part needed to be rewritten, and West offered her services as a writer. Hollywood people were used to dealing with difficult actresses and had a panoply of tactics for taming them, particularly those who wanted their parts rewritten. What was unusual was an actress who offered to rewrite her own lines. Baffled by the request, even from someone who had written for Broadway, the studio executives came back with a firm refusal. Giving her that privilege would set a terrible precedent. West countered by refusing to continue with the film until they let her rewrite the dialogue. Paramount boss Adolph Zucker had seen West's screen test and liked her look and manner. The picture needed her. Zucker had a studio executive take her out to dinner on her birthday to try to cajole her. The goal was to calm her down enough so that they could begin shooting. Once cameras were rolling, he thought, they would find a way to get West to behave. But that night at dinner, West pulled out a check from her handbag and handed it to the executive. It was for $20,000, the amount she had earned to that point. She was giving the money back to the studio and, thanking Paramount for the opportunity, told the executive she was leaving for New York the next morning. Zucker, immediately apprised of this news, was caught completely off balance. West seemed willing to lose substantial money, risk a lawsuit for breach of contract, and guarantee that she would never work in Hollywood again. Zucker took another look at the script. Perhaps she was right and the dialogue was lousy. She would rather give up money and a career than be in an inferior picture. He decided to offer her a compromise. She could write her own dialogue, and they would shoot two versions of the movie, one hers, one the studio's. That would cost a little more, but they would get West on film. If her version was better, which Zucker thought unlikely, that would only improve the picture. If not, they would go with the original version. Paramount couldn't lose. West accepted the compromise, and shooting began. One person, however, was not amused. The director, Archie L. Mayo, a man with an extensive resume. Not only had West changed the script to suit her wisecracking style, she insisted on altering the blocking and camera setups to make the most of her lines. They fought and fought, until one day West refused to go on. She had demanded a shot of her disappearing up some stairs after delivering one of her patented wisecracks. This would give the audience time to laugh. Mayo thought it unnecessary and refused to shoot it. West walked off the set, and production came to a halt. Studio executives agreed that West's lines had lightened up the picture. Let her have her way with the direction and shoot the shot, they told Mayo. They would edit it out later. Production resumed. The other actress in her scenes, Allison Skipworth, had the distinct impression that West was determining the pace of the lines, getting the camera to focus on her, stealing the scene. Protesting that West was taking over the direction of the movie, Skipworth, too, was told not to worry. It would all be fixed in the editing. When it came time to cut the film, however, West had so altered the mood and pace of her scenes that no editing could bring them back to the original. More important, her sense of timing and direction were solid. She had indeed improved the entire picture. The film debuted on October 1932. The reviews were mixed, but almost all agreed that a new star was born. West's aggressive sexual style and wit fascinated the men in the audience. Though she appeared in just a few scenes, she was the only part of the film anyone seemed to remember. Lines she had written, "I'm a girl who lost her reputation and never missed it," were quoted endlessly. As Raft later admitted, Mae West stole everything but the cameras. Audiences were soon clamoring for more Mae West, and Paramount, in financial trouble at the time, could not ignore them. At the age of 40, as plump as ever, West was signed to a long-term contract at the highest salary of any star in the studio. For her next film, Diamond Lil, she would have complete creative control. No other actress, or actor for that matter, had ever pulled off such a coup and in so short a time. Interpretation. When Mae West set foot in Hollywood, everything was stacked against her. She was old and passé. The director and an army of studio executives had just one goal, to use her in a scene or two to animate a dull picture, then ship her back to New York. She had no real power, and if she had chosen to fight on their battlefield, one in which actresses were a dime a dozen and exploited to the fullest, she would have gotten nowhere. West's genius, her form of warfare, was slowly but surely to shift the battlefield to terrain of her choice. She began her war by playing the part of the blonde bombshell, charming and seducing the Paramount men. Her screen test hooked them. She was difficult, but what actress wasn't? Next, she asked to rewrite her lines, and receiving the expected refusal, ratcheted up the stakes by not budging. Returning the money she had been paid was her campaign's key moment. It subtly shifted the focus from a battle with an actress to the script itself. By showing herself ready to give up so much, she made Zucker begin to wonder more about the dialogue than about her. After his compromise, West made her next maneuver, fighting over the blocking, the camera angles, the pacing of the shots. Her writing had become an accepted part of the scenery. The battle now was over her directing. Another compromise, which translated into another victory. Instead of fighting the studio executives on their terms, West had subtly shifted the battle to a field unfamiliar to them, fighting with an actress over the writing and directing of a film. On such terrain, against a smart and seductive woman, the army of Paramount men was lost and helpless. Your enemies will naturally choose to fight on terrain that is to their liking, that allows them to use their power to best advantage. Cede them such power, and you end up fighting on their terms. Your goal is to subtly shift the conflict to terrain of your choice. You accept the battle, but alter its nature. If it is about money, shift it to something moral. If your opponents want to fight over a particular issue, reframe the battle to encompass something larger and more difficult for them to handle. If they like a slow pace, find a way to quicken it. You are not allowing your enemies to get comfortable or fight in their usual way. And an enemy who is lured onto unfamiliar terrain is one who has lost control of the dynamic. Once such control slips from his hands, he will compromise, retreat, make mistakes, and effect his own destruction. 3. By early 1864, the American Civil War had settled into a stalemate. Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia had managed to keep the Union forces away from Richmond, capital of the Confederacy. To the west, the Confederates had established an impregnable defensive position at the town of Dalton, Georgia, blocking any Union advance on Atlanta, the key industrial city of the South. President Abraham Lincoln, facing re-election that year, and gravely worried about his chances if the stalemate continued, decided to name Ulysses S. Grant overall commander of the Union forces. Here was a man who would go on the offensive. Grant's first move was to appoint his chief lieutenant, General William Tecumseh Sherman, to command the Union forces in Georgia. When Sherman arrived on the scene, he realized that any attempt to take Dalton was doomed from the start. The Confederate commander, General John Johnston, was a master at defensive warfare. With mountains to his rear and a solid position to his front, Johnston could simply stay put. A siege would take too long, and a frontal attack would be too costly. The situation seemed hopeless. Sherman decided, then, that if he could not seize Dalton, he would take hold of Johnston's mind, striking fear in a man notorious for being conservative and cautious. In May 1864, Sherman sent 3/4 of his army into a direct attack on Dalton. With Johnston's attention held by this attack, Sherman then sneaked the Army of the Tennessee around the mountains to the town of Resaca, 15 miles to the south of Dalton, blocking Johnston's only real route of retreat and only supply line. Terrified to find himself suddenly surrounded, Johnston had no choice but to give up his position at Dalton. He would not, however, play into Sherman's hands. He simply retreated to another defensive position that gave him maximum security, again inviting Sherman to attack him straight on. This quickly turned into a dance. Sherman would feint going one way, then would somehow divert a part of his army to the south of Johnston, who kept backing up, all the way to Atlanta. The Confederate president, Jefferson Davis, disgusted by Johnston's refusal to fight, replaced him with General John Hood. Sherman knew that Hood was an aggressive commander, often even reckless. He also knew that neither the time nor the men were available to lay siege to Atlanta. Lincoln needed a quick victory. His solution was to send detachments to threaten Atlanta's defenses, but he made these forces temptingly small and weak. Hood could not resist the temptation to leave his stronghold in the city and move to the attack, only to find himself rushing into an ambush. This happened several times, and with each defeat, Hood's army became smaller, and the morale of his men quickly deteriorated. Now, with Hood's army tired and expecting disaster, Sherman played yet another trick. At the end of August, he marched his army southeast, past Atlanta, abandoning his supply lines. To Hood, this could only mean that Sherman had given up the fight for Atlanta. Wild celebration broke out throughout the city. But Sherman had cunningly timed this march to coincide with the ripening of the corn, and with his men well-fed and Hood unsuspecting, he cut off the final railway line still open to Atlanta and wheeled back to attack the unguarded city. Hood was forced to abandon Atlanta. This was the great victory that would ensure Lincoln's reelection. Next came Sherman's strangest maneuver of all. He divided his army into four columns, and completely cutting himself loose from his supply lines, began a march east from Atlanta to Savannah and the sea. His men lived off the land, destroying everything in their path. Unencumbered by supply wagons, they moved with incredible speed. The four parallel columns were far enough apart that the southern forces could not tell where they were headed. The southern column seemed headed for Macon, the northern for Augusta. Confederate forces scrambled to cover both places, leaving the center open, which was exactly where Sherman planned to advance. Keeping the South on what he called the horns of a dilemma, off balance and mystified as to his intentions, Sherman marched all the way to Savannah with hardly a battle. The effect of this march was devastating. For the Confederate soldiers still fighting in Virginia, the ruin of Georgia, where many had left behind homes, was a terrible blow to their morale. Sherman's march cast a mood of deep gloom over the entire South. Slowly but surely, it was losing its will to keep up the fight, Sherman's goal all along. Interpretation. In any conflict, it is often the weaker side that in fact controls the dynamic. In this case, the South was in control in both the strategic and the grand strategic sense. In their immediate local strategy, the Confederates had entrenched themselves in powerful defensive positions in Georgia and Virginia. The temptation for the North was to fight on the enemy's terms, to hurl division after division against these positions at tremendous loss of life and with little chance of advancing. In the South's grand strategy, the longer this stalemate prevailed, the more likely Lincoln was to be thrown out of office. Then the war would end through negotiation. The South set the tempo for the battle, slow and grinding, and controlled the stakes. As Sherman saw it, his goal was not to capture a city or to defeat the Confederates in battle. In his view, the only way to win the war was to regain control of the dynamic. Instead of brutal frontal attacks against Dalton or Atlanta, which would play into the South's hands, he operated indirectly. He frightened the timid Johnston into abandoning his stronghold and goaded the rash Hood into senseless attacks, in both instances playing upon the psychology of the opponent to force the issue. By constantly putting his enemy on the horns of a dilemma, where both staying put and moving were equally dangerous, he took control of the situation without having to waste men in battle. Most important, by demonstrating to the South with his destructive march that the longer the war dragged on, the worse it would be for them, he regained grand strategic control of the war. For the Confederates, to keep fighting was slow suicide. The worst dynamic in war, and in life, is the stalemate. It seems that whatever you do only feeds the stagnation. Once this happens, a kind of mental paralysis overcomes you. You lose the ability to think or respond in different ways. At such a point, all is lost. If you find yourself falling into such a dynamic, dealing with a defensive, entrenched opponent, or trapped in a reactive relationship, you must become as creative as General Sherman. Deliberately shake up the pace of the slow waltz by doing something seemingly irrational. Operate outside the experience of the enemy, as Sherman did when he cut himself loose from his supplies. Move fast here and slow there. One major jolt given to the stale dynamic will shake it up, force the enemy to do something different. With the slightest change, you have room for greater change and taking control. Injecting novelty and mobility is often enough to unbalance the minds of your rigid and defensive opponents. 4. In 1833,